Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Presidents, like the rest of us, are living longer these days, and they're increasingly likely to leave office as relatively young men. That has created a fascinating dynamic for modern White Houses and the politicians who called 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue home in the years just before. The always fluctuating ex-presidents club is America's most exclusive group, necessarily tiny in number but full of often competing egos and interests. Yet throughout the past 100 years, ex-presidents have largely shared a common purpose across party lines, reflective about their service in their golden years, and still willing to pick up the phone or board an international flight when the commander-in-chief asks. Former presidents sometimes find themselves in strange alliances. Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford became friends and allies despite a bitter election, and in recent years, Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush grew so close, Bush family members started calling Clinton a lost son. But the high-stakes nature of post-presidential politics has also led to international crises and protocol mishaps, as each iteration of the club struggles to balance its own historical angling with contemporary patriotism. Time magazine editor and Washington bureau chief Michael Duffy is the co-author of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Michael Duffy, welcome to The Roundtable.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So your book begins during the Truman administration, and Truman began calling on Herbert Hoover, who had really been a Democratic punching bag for 15 years or so. Why did Truman look to Hoover in the first place?
Well, you know, every club has its creation myth, and ours, the President's Club, starts in about 1945. Truman's just been in office a few weeks, and he's got a lot of problems on his hand. The war is coming to an end, and one of the problems with that is that, in addition to demobilization and all the other attendant issues, Europe is really starving. There are 100 million people who don't have food in the aftermath of the war, and he's looking around for somebody who can solve that problem, because it takes a lot of globetrotting and talking countries with food out of it and figuring out ways to get it to food. It turns out the person who is the best at this in the United States of America is Herbert Hoover, who, as you noted, was a pariah, particularly in the still Roosevelt-run White House, even though Truman is now president. Roosevelt used to like to say, you know, I'm not Jesus Christ, I'm not raising Herbert Hoover from the dead. He was such an effective battering ram for the Democrats. Still, David Axelrod today still talks about Herbert Hoover in the race against Mitt Romney. So you can imagine what it was like in 45. Anyway, Truman calls him up, sends him a letter, private, and they finally get together, and Truman sends him around the world for 55 days. And it's really Hoover who, working closely with Truman, those two men solved that food crisis. This is one of the club's greatest hours. Those two men probably saved more lives in 1945 than maybe any two other people in the 20th century.
Advisors were telling Truman not to bring Hoover back into the spotlight and to let him resurrect his reputation. Did Truman, by doing so and defying some of those FDR-era advisors, did he set a path for the way party lines would become blurry in future years between the ex-presidents?
In the 70 years we looked at the club from that moment on, we see over and over that presidents of different parties seem to get along better than presidents from the same party. It's a very curious thing. You know, Truman and Hoover created the club on the dais at Ike's swearing-in 53 when Hoover went up to Truman and said, I think we should start a former president's club. And Truman said, great, you be the president, I'll be the secretary. And I think each man, especially when they're from different parties, is surprised by how much they have in common, whereas presidents from the same party aren't so surprised. What happens is, whether it's Reagan and Nixon, Clinton and Carter, Clinton and Obama, or other same-party rivalries, those men tend to be rivals for history's favor. Who can, for example, you know, in the case of Clinton and Obama, pull a center-right nation a little more to the left? Who's better at that? Who has the right formula? Same with Nixon and Reagan in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Which president really was the truer conservative? So they have rivalries that men across parties actually don't have. And that surprised us. We didn't expect to find that.
Now, we should say the President's Club is a cute phrase and all, but there are actual legal stipulations to what ex-presidents get, and they even have a clubhouse. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we really went into this thinking the club was our phrase, our conceit, just a construct for talking about the book when we were putting it together. But we realized quickly they think of it as a club. You know, Hoover called it our mutual trade union, and Reagan actually referred to it as a club, and of course Hoover and Truman kind of figured out how to start it. And as the presidencies go on through the 20th century, each president adds something a little new. You know, Eisenhower gave them a pension, and Johnson gave them Secret Service protection, and Nixon was so addled and bothered by Lyndon Johnson, who had retired to the ranch in Texas, that who was constantly calling with, you know, needs. He was a needy guy. He wanted, you know, planes and trains and a place to work and stay in Washington. He finally said to a young military aide, just find him a place to live here. And that aide, whose name was Colonel Brent Scowcroft, would look around Lafayette Square and find a sort of a rundown townhouse, and he turned it into the former president's house, and it's still there, unmarked building, a couple doors down from Blair House on Lafayette Square, and it's just been very nicely renovated by George W. Bush before he left office.
So now, moving ahead in the timeline a little bit, Ike was one of the really rising stars of the post-war era, and Truman saw this coming. But it's interesting that both Democratic presidents who sandwiched the 8 years of Eisenhower had different reasons to call upon him. Kennedy, during the Bay of Pigs crisis, had a famous photo op with Eisenhower at Camp David. And Eisenhower, politically, you know, didn't have to make that move, but he decided to, for solidarity, go visit JFK and kind of bestow some leadership upon him. Anyway, how did Truman and Eisenhower break up for so long and then come back together as friends?
It's a very
later?
Amazing story. Truman liked Ike a lot when Truman was president. I think Truman might have imagined that Eisenhower would be a Democrat. In 1948, he told Eisenhower, look, Ike, if you want to be president, go ahead and run. I'll step aside. I'll be your vice president. Ike wasn't ready to be president yet, but in 52 he was, and by then he was pretty clearly a Republican, and that was a little harder for Truman. The two men came to falling out during late in that race when Truman felt that Ike had missed a big opportunity while campaigning in Wisconsin to say something critical about Joe McCarthy, who had begun to attack a man Truman loved, George Marshall, the former five-star head of the U.S. Armed Forces. And Truman felt that Ike had missed an important moral opportunity to criticize McCarthy, but Ike didn't want to do that in the heat of a campaign in a key swing state, just as key then as it is today. And Truman went nuts. He sort of said, I'm done with Ike. I trusted him, I liked him, and I completely misjudged him. And he spent some weeks on the campaign in 1952 running against Eisenhower. And, of course, Truman wasn't even on the ballot that year. He just decided to make Ike the issue. The two men didn't speak for all 8 years of Ike's presidency. He never visited the White House. And the thaw only came, you know, early in the 1960s, when some of their mutual friends began to die, and they'd run into each other as funerals. But they didn't really talk until after, in November of 63, when they shared a limousine back from Arlington. And it pulled up to Blair House, where both men were staying, and Truman said to Ike, want to come up for a drink? And the two men did, and they went up and they kind of buried the hatchet and got over it as everyone's mortality kind of hung in the air. So a long period of not talking, followed by, I think, a period of realizing they had more in common than they had apart, that separated them.
Now, that was a relationship and a closeness that his vice president, Eisenhower's vice president, Nixon, never shared with Eisenhower. Now, when Nixon is president, that's the last moment when there have been no living ex-presidents. And I wondered how that influenced Nixon's own role as an ex-president, because he was so needy when it came to rehabilitation and had something to offer on the world stage for future presidents, but he could also be just as conniving as he was while in the White House.
You know, I after having done the book with Nancy Gibbs, my co-author, I think we liked all the presidents better as a result of taking this deep dive into their relationships, with the possible exception of Nixon, who you're right, as soon as he resigned, began a 20-year campaign for redemption. And he kept his head down mostly, though not entirely, during Ford and Carter, and began to reemerge during Reagan, who sought his advice actively, listened to it, and took it. Not always, but certainly in the first half of his 8 years, and less so in the second, when they began to differ about how to treat an emerging post-Soviet Russia. Nixon was a handful for George Herbert Walker Bush on the same issue. Nixon didn't really give anyone much ground on foreign policy. He felt that was his his great strength, and of course that was where his greatest triumphs were, so he kept working that when he was an ex-president. But the most astonishing relationship, I think, with Nixon and any former president is the late-night phone relationship he develops with Bill Clinton, of all people, really a generation apart, a different party, a man who Clinton, obviously his wife, had worked on the House Judiciary Committee impeachment efforts of Nixon. So a surprising, I think, to both of them, Clinton found Nixon's advice really hard-headed and smart, and he couldn't really tell everyone in his team about it because, you know, how could Clinton be seen taking advice from Nixon in 1993 and 4? On the other hand, Nixon found Clinton fascinating because he was a young president who had all kinds of questions that he remembered having himself. How do you organize your day? When do you nap? You know, how do you do this job? So they became unusual and regular correspondents, usually by phone, usually late at night. And when we saw Clinton and talked to him about this last year, I remember he was able to quote something Nixon had once sent him in a letter early in 1994, late in Nixon's life. And how do you remember that quote? And he goes, well, I get out that letter every year and reread it. So obviously it had an impact.
Okay, so another recent president, this one's still living, who has given all of the presidents to come after him fits at different points is Jimmy Carter, probably none more than Bill Clinton himself, because they were both Southern Democrats and longtime rivals, really dating back to Clinton's time as a governor in Arkansas. Carter left office. He was hugely unpopular and has built a great post-presidency. But why is he so hard to wrangle by all of the White Houses since?
I once asked someone who worked with Jimmy Carter for years this question, and he said, it's just the way he is, which was as good an answer as I can find. You know, on September 7th, Jimmy Carter became the longest-living former American president in history. 31 years, 8 months, and 21 or 22 days, out surpassing Herbert Hoover's record, who lived from about 33 to 64.
And famously said that he had outlived the bastards.
When he asked me, people said how he had overcome it, he said, I just outlived my enemies. I outlived the bastards. Carter is tossed out of office in 1980 and 81, and he's looking down the road and he realizes, oh no, I have 35, 40 years to live, and I have nothing to do. And he was depressed, and he struggled with it. He's talked about it. He's written about it. It was a real existential crisis. And he then reinvented what it means to be an ex-president. He'll say in public, and he said this, and he's right, you know, I'm a better former president than I was president. It's not all that surprising in that he's had 7 times longer to be a former president than he had to be a president. But he has made an astonishing life for himself and his wife. They've gone all over the world. They have engaged in every conceivable form of humanitarian aid to all kinds of countries. I don't think there's a country he hasn't visited. They may not like Carter in the club very much, but he is the model for all of them. And they all have asked him to do things. Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama have all sent him overseas on missions that were too sensitive or complicated for any of their own people to handle. So they have relied on him, and they look to his model after they leave. Just as, interestingly enough, Carter went to talk to Nixon after he left about how to set up a life. So the club helps each other not only while in office, but as they begin to be out of office. And those stories are as human as they are political.
At the same time, there's also a reverence for the office and a feeling of needing to protect the office, which you cover in the book. During the Clinton impeachment crisis, Gerald Ford, of all people, was out there lobbying not for Clinton necessarily, but for the presidency.
The club has many roles, but one of the things it does acts as a kind of shadow secret service, protecting not the president, but the presidency. I think they all come out of office sharing a lot of things, but one of the important ones is that they recognize how fragile and limited the power of the office is, and you can't just snap your fingers and get stuff done. And they all emerge at the end of 4-8 years, whether they're successful or not, quite in agreement about how in our politics, which are not working that great, we have to have a strong commander-in-chief. That's something they all believe in with a kind of almost religious fervor, because they've all both used it in ways we'll never know, I'm sure, and been unable to use it. So whether it's Hoover helping Truman redo the executive branch in the late 40s with the Hoover Commission, or Ike helping Johnson with public and private strategy on the Vietnam War, or Gerald Ford working behind the scenes on the phones with Clinton to try to cut a deal to avoid an impeachment vote in the Senate in 1998. And those backroom, back-channel phone calls were astonishing, which Gerald Ford, having pardoned Richard Nixon 25 years earlier, but not really gotten a statement of apology or contrition from Nixon, and regretting that, tries to get Clinton this time to issue one, to admit that he lied. And Clinton wants a deal, and he wants to avoid the trial in the Senate, but he doesn't want to go that far. And to hear them, the reports of those calls, it really shows how sometimes the only person you're willing to talk to when you're president is a peer. There aren't many of them. We saw over and over again that they all come out of office with scars and bruises, even the successful ones, and things they would have liked to have done differently. But there are only a limited number of people who understand what that's like. Those are, we all have regrets, but theirs might be just a little bigger than most of ours. And so the club is a place where you don't really have to explain yourself, where everyone understands that, you know, you walk a little differently after you've had that job than you did before. And it isn't always comfortable.
You know, the politics of the club certainly changed during a presidential election year. I'm thinking of Bill Clinton's recent speech at the Democratic National Convention. He is now a player in this campaign in a way that sort of complicates the rules. But I wonder how President Obama has called upon this club. He had that famous photo op early on when all of the living presidents came to visit the White House. Jimmy Carter famously standing a few feet away from the rest of them, which a lot of people noticed at the time. But I wonder, has Obama been known for relying on the club as much as some of his predecessors?
Well, not yet. He's probably, perhaps, you know, the president's club is the president's to use. And sometimes he's called and they've refused to help him. You know, after Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan, he invited the club to come to Ground Zero in New York and gather, and the club said, nope, not doing that. That's too political. And, you know, on the other hand, he's visited Bush 1 in Texas, in College Station, at his library there, and I think certainly improved the relationship. He has had a rocky up and down, back and forth relationship with Bill Clinton, who practically campaigned against when he faced Hillary in 2008, but they have worked slowly, kind of herky-jerky, back to a relationship until we could have that astonishing moment in Charlotte where Clinton bowed to him. That was quite something. But it hasn't all been Skittles and beer the whole time, and the two men do have this, I think, philosophical difference about how to advance a progressive agenda in a conservative era. I think they would say that. And he has very little relationship with his immediate predecessor, George Walker Bush, who has, I think, been classy in saying, you know, Obama deserves my silence. I think that's accurate. I think that's a move he learned from his father. And I'm sure that Obama appreciates that. And even, it's interesting, you know, even when Bush has said the very few things he will say in public about politics, he tends to be very deferential to Obama. For example, I think in May or June, someone asked him about tax or energy policy, and all Bush II would say is, I might have done that a little differently, but he said, quote, I don't believe that our country should criticize our president. And I think he knows how difficult it is to do the job, and you don't need someone kind of sniping from the sidelines. It's another courtesy the club pays to its members.
We've been speaking with Michael Duffy, Time Magazine editor and Washington bureau chief. He's also the co-author of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. I was so excited when I saw this book coming out, and I loved reading it, and I really enjoyed our interview. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.